For now, that must be enough. Shalamasa stepped close as she dared to get. You have borne children. You have loved a man, many men, truth be told. I thought that one day I could say the same for myself. I thought I could look back and be satisfied. You don't deserve to die, Shalamasa. I could not agree with you more, and so you shall not. We will do whatever must be done. We will live through this. She cut herself off then, and Shalamasa looked up to see her staring back at the Kundril camp. She followed the older woman's gaze. Gaul had appeared, and at his side stood Jastara, his eldest son's widow. Shalamasa moved to block Hanavat from their view and then walked over.
War leader,
she hissed.
How many times will you wound her?
The warrior seemed to have aged a dozen years since she had last seen him, but it did nothing to cool her fury, and in his unwillingness to meet her eyes, she saw only cowardice. We go to our sons this night, he said. Tell her that. I do not mean to wound, tonight or the next. Soon.
Soon,
said Jastara, her tone harsh.
And I will see my husband again. I will walk at his side.
Shalamasa felt disgust twisting her face.
After sleeping with his father? Will you, Jastara? Is his spirit here? Does he see you? Does he know all that you have done? Yet you tell yourself you will be at his side again. You are mad.
A hand settled on her shoulder and she turned.
Hanavat, no! You are so quick to defend me, Shalamasa, and for that I am ever grateful. But I will speak to my husband.
Jastara had backed away at Shalamasa's words, and a moment later she fled, pushing through the crowd that had gathered. A few of the older women spun to strike at her when she rushed past. A dozen youths gathered nearby laughed, and one reached down for a stone.
Belay that, scout!
At the bark, the girl froze. Captain Fiddler was walking into the Kundril camp to collect his scouts. He glanced over at Gaul, Hanavat, and Shalamasa, and for an instant it seemed he was simply going to continue on to his charges, but then he altered his path and approached.
No disrespect intended, Mother Hanavat, but we don't have time for all this shit. Your histories are just that, a heap of stories you keep dragging everywhere you go. War leader Gaul, all that doom you're bleating on about is a waste of breath. We're not blind, none of us. The only question you have to deal with now is how are you going to face that end? Like a warrior, or on your hood damned knees?
Then ignoring the crowd, Fiddler made his way towards his troop.
We're on point this night, scouts. Take up those spears and let's get moving. The column's about to march.
Shalamasa watched the Malazan lead the youths away. From Hanavat, a low laugh, and then,
no disrespect, he said. And then he went and slapped us all down. Mother!
No, he was right, Shalamasa.
We stand here, naked but for our pride, yet see how heavy it weighs. Well, this night I think I will try to step lighter. After all, what have I left to lose? Your child.
As if Hanavat had read her mind, she reached up and brushed Shalamasa's cheek.
I will die first, she whispered, and the one within me shall quickly follow. If this is how it must be, then I must accept it, as must we all.
She faced her husband then.
But not on our knees. We are Kundril. We are the burned tears.
Gaul said,
if I had not led us down to Arran, our children would still be alive. I have killed our children, Hanavat. I need you to hate me.
I know, husband.
Shalamasa could see that beseeching need in Gaul's reddened eyes, but his wife gave him nothing more. He tried again.
Wife, the burned tears died at the charge.
Hanavat simply shook her head, then took Shalamasa's hand and led her into the camp. It was time to leave. They had to see to the horses. Shalamasa spared one glance back and saw Gaul standing alone, hands covering his face.
In grief, murmured Hanavat,
People will do anything to escape what cannot be escaped. Shelamasa, you must go to Jastara. You must take back your words.
I will not.
It is not for you to judge. Yet how often is it that those in no position to judge are the first to do so, and with such fire and venom? Speak to her, Shelamasa. Help her find some peace.
But how can I, when just to think of her fills me with disgust?
I did not suggest it would be easy, daughter.
I will give it some thought.
Very well. Just don't wait too long. The army lifted into motion like a beast mired in mud. One last exhausted heave forward, weight dragging it down. The wagons lurched behind the teams of haulers as they strapped on their harnesses and took up the ropes. Scores of tents were left standing, along with a scattering of cookpots and soiled clothing lying like trampled flags. Flies roiled in clouds to swarm the hunched-over, silent soldiers, and overhead the glow of the jade strangers was brighter than any moonlight, bright enough for Lostara Yil to see every detail on the painted shields of the regulars, which they now carried to keep the flies from their backs. The lurid green painted drawn, lined faces with a ghastly, corpulent hue and made unearthly the surrounding desert. Clouds of butterflies wheeled above like ever-building storms. Lostara stood with Henar Vigolf at her side, watching the adjunct draw on her cloak, watching her lifting the hood. She had taken to leading the vanguard herself, 5 or 6 paces ahead of everyone else, excepting Captain Fiddler's 30 or so Cundril youths who ranged ahead 100 paces, scouts with nothing to scout. Lostara's eyes stayed on the adjunct. "In Blue Rose," said Henar, "there is a festival of the Black-Winged Lord once every 10 years on winter's longest night. The High Priestess shrouds herself and leads a procession through the city."
"This Black-Winged Lord is your god?"
"Unofficially, under the suspicious regard of the Letheri. Highly prescribed, in fact. But this procession was one of the few that they did not outlaw."
"You were celebrating the year's longest night?"
"Not really, not in the fashion that farmers might each winter, to celebrate the coming of the planting season. Very few farms around Blue Rose. We were mostly seafaring. Well, maritime, anyway. It was meant to summon our god, I suppose. I was not much for making sense of such things. And as I said, it was once every 10 years. Lostara waited. Henar wasn't a talkative man, thank Hood. But when he spoke, he always had something useful to say, eventually. "Hooded, she'd walk silent streets, followed by thousands equally mute, down to the water's edge. She would stand just beyond the reach of the surf. An acolyte would come up to her carrying a lantern, which she would take in one hand. And at the moment of dawn's first awakening, she would fling that lantern into the water, quenching its light." Lostara grunted.
"Curious ritual. Instead of the lantern, then, the sun. Sounds like you were worshipping the coming of day more than anything else."
"Then she would draw a ceremonial dagger and cut her own throat."
Shaken, Lostara Yil faced him, but found she had nothing to say. No response seemed possible. Then a thought struck her. "And that was a festival the Letheri permitted?"
"They would come down and watch, picnicking on the strand." He shrugged. "For them, it was one less irritating high priestess, I suppose."
Her gaze returned to the adjunct. She had just set out, a shrouded figure hidden from all behind her by that plain hood. The soldiers fell in after her, and the only sound that came from them was the dull clatter of their armor, the thump of their boots. Lostara Yil shivered and leaned close to Henar.
"The hood," Henar muttered. "It reminded me, that's all." She nodded, but she dreaded the thought of that story coming back to haunt them.
"I can't believe I died for this," Hedge said, wanting to spit, but there wasn't enough in his mouth to do it,
and of course he'd have to be mad to waste the water.
He turned and glared at the three oxen pulling Bevedikt's carriage.
Got any more of that drink you gave them? They're looking damned hale, alchemist. We could all do with a sip or three.
Hardly, commander, Bevedikt said, one hand on the hawser. They've been dead for 3 days now.
Hedge squinted at the nearest beast.
Well, now, I'm impressed, I admit it. Impressed, and that can't be said often of old Hedge.
In Letheras, Bevedikt said, there are dozens of people wandering around who are in fact dead and have been for some time. Necromantic alchemy is one of the most advanced of the uneasy arts among the Lethari. In fact, of all the curse elixirs I sold, the one achieving everlasting undeath was probably the most popular. As much as anything costing a chestful of gold can be popular.
Could you do this for a whole army?
Bevedikt blanched.
Commander, such things are prohibitively difficult to achieve. Preparing a single curse vial, for example, involves months of back-breaking effort. Denatured Utulu spawn, the primary ingredient. Well, you'd be lucky to get 3 drops a night, and harvesting is terribly risky. Not to mention exhausting, even for a man reputedly as skilled as myself.
Ulatu spawn, huh? Never heard of it. Never mind, then. It was just a notion. But you got any more of that stuff?
No, sir. I judged as greatest the need of the bridge burners for the munitions in this carriage.
Shh! Don't use that word, you fool!
Sorry, sir. Perhaps, then, we should invent some other term. Something innocuous that we could use freely.
Hedge rubbed at his whiskered jaw.
Good idea. How about kittens?
Kittens, sir? Why not? Now then, our carriage full of kittens is not something that can be abandoned, is it, sir? And I should tell you, the entire company of bridge burners has not the strength to haul it.
Really? Well, just how many kittens you got stuffed in there?
It's the raw ingredients, sir. Bottles and casks and vials and, tubing, condensers, distillation apparatuses. Without 2 cats of opposite gender, sir, making kittens is not an easy venture.
Hedge stared for a moment and then nodded.
Oh, ah, of course, alchemist, just so.
He glanced to his right, where a squad of marines had just come up alongside them. But their attention was on the wagon loaded with food and water that they were guarding. Or so Hedge assumed, since they were resting hands on hilts and looking belligerent.
Well, keep at it then, Bevedikt. Never can have too many kittens, can we?
Precisely, sir.
6 paces behind the two men, Rum Jugs leaned close to Sweet Lard.
I had me some kittens once, you know.
Sweet Lard shot her an unsurprised look.
Errant knows you'll take coin from anybody, love. He had a swagger, I remember that much, and how I'd get sick, my stomach burning like I'd swallowed coals every time he came into the house. Ma, she was a bird, really, the kind that flits about as if no branch gives comfort, no leaf makes perfect shade. And her eyes would leap to him and then away again. But in that one look, she'd know if something bad was on the way. If it was, she'd edge closer to me. The jay is in the tree, the chick is in danger. But there was nothing she could do. He weighed twice as much as she did. He once threw her through the shack's flimsy wall. That time was something of a mistake for old Da, since it took outside what went on inside. So people saw the truth of it all. My little family. There must have been a neighbour, someone on the street, who'd seen and decided he didn't much like it. A day later, Da was dragged back to the house, beaten close to death. And there we were, Ma and her 2 boys. That was before my brother ran away. There we were, nursing him back. How stupid was that? We should have finished what that right-thinking neighbour had started, but we didn't.
That swagger and Ma darting about. I remember the last day of all that. I was 7, almost 8. Quiet Ginnance, who lived up the street and worked as a knife sharpener, had been found strangled in the alley behind his shop. People were upset. Ginnance had been solid, an old veteran of the Fallah Wars, and though he had a weakness for drink, he wasn't a violent drunk, not at all. Too much ale, and he wanted to seduce every woman he saw. A sweet soul, then. That's what Ma used to say, hands fluttering like wings. So people were upset. He'd been drunk the night before, in no shape to defend himself. The rope that had killed him was horsehair. I remember how people talked about that, as if it was important, though I didn't know why at the time. But they'd found horsehairs in Gin's neck. The old women who shared a house on the corner, 3 of them, seemed to be looking at us again and again. We were outside, listening to everybody talking, all those emotions running high. Ma was white as plucked down. Da was on the bench beside the shack's door. He'd gotten a rash on his hands and was slowly melting a lump of lard between them. There'd been a strange look in his eye, but for once he wasn't offering any opinion on the matter. Horsehair. A tradition among the outliers, the wood-cutting camps east of the city. How adulterers are hung, aye? And the old women nodded. But old Ginnance, he ain't never. No, couldn't, ye see. Got burned down there. Was on a ship that caught fire when they took Fallah Harbour. He couldn't do nothing. The drunk seducer with nowhere to take it. How shit-fouled miserable is that? Breaks the heart. And he'd always a kind word for Ma, when she went to him to get the one knife we owned sharpened. Hardly charged a thing, either. That blade a mouse couldn't shave with. Ha! Hey, boy, your Ma ever let you shave a mouse? Good practice for when one shows up under your nose. Few years yet, though. So, said someone in the crowd, a jealous man. No, make it a jealous, stupid man. With wood for brains. And a few people laughed, but they weren't pleasant laughs. People were working up to something. People knew something. People were figuring it out. Like a bird in a thorn bush, Ma slipped inside without a sound. I followed her, thinking about poor old Ginnance and wondering who was going to sharpen Ma's knife now. But Da got up right then and went in a step before me. His hands were dripping melted fat. I don't remember exactly what I saw, just a flash, really. Up close to Da's face, just under his huge bearded jaw. And he made a gurgling sound and his knees bent as if he was about to sit down, right on me. I jumped back, tripped in the doorway and landed in the dust beside the bench. Da was making spitting sounds, but not from his mouth, from his neck. And when he landed on his knees, twisting round in the doorway as if wanting to come back outside, the front of his chest was all wet and bright red. I looked into my father's eyes, and for the first and only time in my life with him, I actually saw something alive in there. A flicker, a gleam that went out for good as he slumped on the threshold. Behind him, Ma stood holding that little knife in her right hand. Here you go, boy. Hold it careful now. It's sharp enough to shave a mouse. Bridge burner magic, what I can do with decent iron. Give us another smile, sweet Elaid. It's all the payment I ask, darling. Well now, recruit, you ever stand still? Seen you going round and round and round. Tell me, was your old man a court clown or something? No, Master Sergeant, my Da was a woodcutter. Really? Outlier blood? But you're a scrawny thing for a woodcutter's son. Not one for the trade, then? He died when I was 7, Master Sergeant. I was of no mind to follow his ways. I ended up learning most from my Ma's side of the family. Had an aunt and uncle who worked with animals. Found you a name, lad? Master Sergeant? See, I wrote it right here, making it official. Your name is Widdershins, and you're now a Marine. Now get out of my sight and get someone to beat those dogs. That barking's driving me mad.
How's the stomach, Wid?
Burns like coal, Sergeant.
A half dozen regulars were coming up alongside them. The one in the lead eyed Balm and said,
Fist Blistig have signed us to this one, Sergeant. We got it in hand. Best under a blanket, Corporal, said Balm.
Throat Slitter piped an eerie laugh, and the squad of regulars jumped at the sound.
Your help's always welcome, Balm added, but from now on these wagons got details of Marines to help guard 'em.
The Corporal looked nervous enough for Widdershins to give him a closer look.
Now that's an awfully plump face for someone on 3 tiny cups a day.
The Corporal was stubborn or stupid enough to try again.
Fist Blistig! Ain't commanding Marines, Corporal. But tell you what, go to him and tell him all about this conversation, why don't you? If he's got a problem, he can come to me. I'm Sergeant Balm, 9th Squad. Or, if I rank too low for him on all this, why, he can hunt down Captain Fiddler, who's up ahead on point.
Balm cocked his head and scratched his jaw.
Seem to recall from my basic training days that a fist outranks a captain. Hey, Dead Smell, is that right?
Mostly, Sergeant, but sometimes, well, it depends on the fist. And the captain, added Throat Slitter, nudging Widdershins with a sharp elbow.
Now there's a point, Balm mused. Kind of sticky, like a hand under a blanket.
Throat Slitter's second laugh sent them scurrying.
Those soldiers looked flush,
Widdershins muttered once they'd retreated into the gloom.
At first, well, the poor fools were just following orders, so I thought you was being unkind, Sergeant. But now I got some suspicions.
That's an executable offence, said Deadsmell. What you're suggesting there, Wid?
It's going to happen soon, if it hasn't already,
Widdershins said, grimacing.
We all know it. Why do you think Fid nailed us to these wagons?
Throat Slitter added.
Heard we was getting our heavies for this, but then we weren't. Nervous, Throaty?
Widdershins asked.
Only the four of us, after all. The scariest thing about us is your awful laugh. Worked, though, didn't it?
They went to moan at their captain or whoever, Balm said. They'll be back with reinforcements, is my guess.
Widdershins jabbed Throat Slitter with his elbow, avenging that earlier prod.
Scared, Throaty? Only of your breath, Wid. Get away from me.
Got another squad on the other side of these wagons, Balm pointed out. Anyone see which one?
They all looked over, but the 3 lines of wretched haulers mostly blocked their view. Throat Slitter grunted.
Could be Whiskey Jack himself. If we get in trouble, they won't be able to get through.
What's your problem?
Balm demanded. Throat Slitter bared his teeth.
This is thirst we're dealing with here, Sergeant. No, all of you. Where I came from, droughts hit often, and the worst was when the city was besieged. And with Li Heng, well, during the scraps with the city, that was pretty much every summer. So I know about thirst, all right. Once the fever strikes, there's no stopping it.
Well, isn't that cheery? You can stop talking now, Throat Slitter, and that's an order.
I think it's Badan Grook's squad, said Deadsmell.
Balm snorted. Widdershins frowned.
That's a problem, Sergeant? They're Dalhanese just like you, aren't they?
Don't be an idiot. They're from the southern jungles.
So are you, aren't you?
Even if I was, and I'm not saying I wasn't, or was, that'd make no difference. You understand me, Wid?
No. Tace Wren himself couldn't have worked out what you just said, Sergeant.
It's complicated, that's all, but Badan Grook. Well, could be worse, I suppose. Though, like Throaty said, we'd both have trouble supporting the other. I wish Fid ain't pulled the heavies from us. What do you think he's done with them?
Deadsmell said.
It was Faradan Salt who come up after kindly to talk to the captain, and I wasn't deliberately eavesdropping or nothing. I just happened to be standing close, so I didn't catch it all, but I think there might be some trouble with the food haulers on the back end. I'm thinking that's where the heavies went.
What, to lighten the loads?
Throatslitter yelped. Lapdwell scratched at the end of his nose where the tip had once been.
Kind of insulting, he muttered. Them calling themselves bridge burners.
Burnt Rope glanced over at the company marching on his left, squinted at the three oxen plodding the way oxen plodded the world over.
It's how it looks when you get someone doing something nobody wants to do. Draft animals. Of course, it's all down to stupidity, isn't it? Do the work, get food, do more work to get more food. Over and over again. Not like us at all. I don't care what they call themselves, Lap. They're marching just like us, in the same mess, and when we're all bleached bones, well, who could tell the difference between any of us?
I could, Lapdwell said. Easy. Just by looking at the skulls. I can tell if it's a woman or a man, young or old. I can tell if it's a city-born fool or a country one. Where I apprenticed back in Falar, my master had shelves and shelves of skulls. Was doing a study. He could tell a Napan from a Quan, a Jenabakan from a Cartulian.
Corporal Clasp, walking a step ahead, snorted loudly and then half-turned.
And you believed him, Lap? Let me guess, that's how he made his living, isn't it? Wasn't it you, Falari, who had that thing about burying relatives in the walls of your houses? So when rival claims to some building came up, why, everyone ran to the skull scryers.
My master was famous for settling disputes.
I just bet he was. Listen, working out a man or woman, old or young, sure, I'll buy that. But the rest, forget it, Lap.
Why are we talking about skulls again?
Burnt Rope asked. When no one seemed able to come up with an answer, he went on.
Anyway, I'm thinking it's all right that we got them bridge burners so close instead of them regulars. If we get mobbed at this wagon here, we could call on them to help.
Why would they do that?
Lapdwell demanded.
Can't say, but Deadhedge, he's a real bridge burner.
Yeah, drawled Clasp. I heard that too. Pure rubbish, you know. They're all dead. Everyone knows that.
Not Fiddler.
Except Fiddler.
And Fiddler and Hedge were in the same squad, along with Quick Ben. So Hedge is for real.
All right, fine. So it isn't pure rubbish. But him helping us is. We get in trouble here, we got no one else to look to for help. Tar's squad is on the other side of the haulers. No way to reach us. So just stay sharp, especially when the midnight bell sounds.
From ahead of them all, Sergeant Erb had glanced back.
Everyone relax, he said. There won't be any trouble.
What makes you so sure, Sergeant?
Because, Corporal Clasp, we got bridge burners marching beside us, and they got kittens.
Burnt Rope joined the others in solemn nodding. Erb knew his stuff. They were lucky to have him. Even with salt licks sent off back column, they would be fine. Burnt Rope glanced enviously at that huge, leathery carriage.
Wish I had me some of them kittens.
If anything, letting go was the easiest among all the choices left. The other choices crowded together, jostling and unpleasant, and stared with belligerent expressions, waiting, expectant. And he so wanted to turn away from them all. He so wanted to let go.
Instead, the captain just walked, his scouts whispering around him like a score of childhood memories. He didn't want them around, but he couldn't send them away either. It was what he was stuck with. It's what we're all stuck with.
And so there was no letting go, not from any of this. He knew what the adjunct wanted and what she wanted of him.
And my marines and my heavies. And none of it's fair, and we both know it. And that's not fair either.
Those other choices, willing him to meet their eye, stood before him like an unruly legion.
Take us, Fiddler. We're all that you meant to say 1,000 times in your life, when you looked on and remained silent, when you let it all slide past instead of taking a step right into the path of all that shit, all that cruel misery, when you let it go, and felt bits of you die inside, small ones. Barely a sting, and then gone. But they add up, soldier, don't they?
So she says, don't let go this time, don't sidestep. She says, well, you know what she says. Fiddler wasn't surprised that the chiding voice within him, the voice of those hardened choices ahead, was Whiskey Jack's. He could almost see his sergeant's eyes, blue and grey, the colour of honed weapons, the colour of winter skies, fixing upon him that knowing look, the one that said, you'll do right, soldier, because you don't know how to do anything else. Doing right, soldier, is the only thing you're good at. And if it hurts, too bad. Stop your bitching, Fid. Besides, you ain't as alone as you think you are. He grunted. Now where had that thought come from? No matter. It was starting to look like the whole thing was useless. It was starting to look like this desert was going to kill them all. But until then, he'd just go on and on, walking. Walking. A small, grubby hand tugged at his jerkin. He looked down. The boy pointed ahead. Walking. Fiddler squinted, shapes in the distance, figures appearing out of the darkness. Walking. God's below, he whispered. Walking. Chapter 15. And all the ages past have nothing to say. They rest easy underfoot, uttering not a whisper. They are dead as the eyes that looked upon them. Riding the dust that gathers in lost and forgotten corners, you won't find them scratched in scrolls or between the bindings of leather-bound tomes, not once carved on stelae and stone walls. They do not hide, waiting to be found, like treasures of truth or holy revelation. Not one of the ages past will descend from the heavens, cupped in the hand of a god, or clutched tight by a stumbling prophet. All these ages past remain forever untouched, with lessons unlearned by the fool who can do nothing but stare ahead to where stands the future, grinning with empty eyes. Helpless Days, Fisher Keltath. Time had become meaningless. Their world now rolled like waves, back and forth, awash with blood. Yan Tovis fought with her people. She could match her brother's savagery, if not his skill. She could cut down Leosan until the muscles of her arm finally failed, and she'd back away, dragging her sword behind her. Until the rainy, flat blackness unfurled from the corners of her vision, and she staggered, chest screaming for breath, moments from slipping into unconsciousness, but somehow each time managing to pull herself back, pushing clear of the press and stumbling among the wounded and dying. And then down onto her knees, because another step was suddenly impossible, and all around her swirled the incessant tidal flow and ebb, the blur of figures moving from body to body, and the air was filled with terrible sound, shrieks of pain, the shouts of the cutters and stretcher-bearers, the roar of endless, eternal battle. She understood so much more now, about the world, about the struggle to survive in that world, in any world, but she could find words for none of it. These revelations were ineffable, too vast for the intellect to conquer. She wanted to weep, but her tears were long gone, and all that remained precious could be found in the next breath she took, and the one after that, each one stunning her with its gift. Reaching up one trembling forearm, she wiped blood and grime from her face. A shadow passed over her, and she lifted her head to see the close pass of another dragon. But it did not descend to the breach, not this time. Instead, lifting high, seeming to hover a moment behind the curtain of lightfall before backing away and vanishing into the glare. Relief came in a nauseating rush that had her leaning forward. Someone came to her side, resting a light arm across her back.
Highness, here, water, drink.
Yan Tovis looked up. The face was familiar, only in that she'd seen this woman again and again in the press, fighting with an Andean pike. Grateful, yet sick with guilt, she nodded and took the water skin.
They've lost the will for it, Highness,
again. It's the shock. The shock, yes, that. Half of my people are dead or too wounded to fight on, as many lesserly, and my brother stands tall still, as if it's all going to plan. As if he's satisfied by our stubborn insanity, this thing he's made of us all. The smith will bend the iron to his will. The smith does not weep when the iron struggles and resists, when it seeks to find its own shape, its own truth. He hammers the sword until he beats out a new truth, edged and deadly. Highness, the last of the blood has shattered. I saw souls trapped within, breaking apart. Highness, I saw them screaming, but I heard nothing.
Jan Tovis straightened, and now it was time to be the one giving comfort. Yet she'd forgotten how.
Those lost within, soldier, will forever stand upon the shore. There are worse places to be.
If she could, she would flinch at her own tone, so lifeless, so cold. Despite that, she felt something like will steal back into the young woman. It seemed impossible.
Yedan, what have you made of my people?
How long ago was it? In a place where days could not be measured, where the only tempo was the wash and flood of howling figures, this tide seething into the heart of midnight, she had no answer to this simplest of questions. Lifting the waterskin, she drank deep, and then, half in dread, half in disbelief, she faced Lightfall. And the wound, where the last of the Leosans still alive on this side were falling to shake swords and Andean pikes. Her brother was down there. He had been down there for what seemed forever, impervious to exhaustion, as units disengaged and others stumbled forward to relieve them, as the warriors of his watch fell one by one, as veterans of the first battle stepped to the fore in their place, as they too began to fall, and shake veterans arrived, like this woman at her side.
Brother, you can kill forever, but we cannot keep up with you. No one can. I see an end to this when you stand alone and the dead shall be your ground.
She turned to the soldier.
You need to rest. Deliver this news to Queen Drukorlat. The blood wall has shattered. The Leosan have retreated. Half of us remain.
The woman stared, and then looked around, as if only now realizing the full extent of the horror surrounding them. The heaps of corpses, the entire strand, a mass of supine bodies under blood-soaked blankets. She saw her mouth the word half.
When in the palace, rest, eat.
But the soldier was shaking her head.
Highness, I have one brother left to me. I cannot stay in the palace. I cannot leave his side for too long. I'm sorry, I shall deliver your message and then return at once.
Jan Tovis wanted to rail at her, but she bit down on her fury. For it was meant not for this woman, but for Jedan Derig, who had done this to her people.
Tell me then, where is your brother?
The woman pointed to a boy sleeping in a press of Sheikh fighters resting nearby. The vision seemed to stab deep into Jan Tovis, and she struggled to stifle a sob.
Be with him then. I will find another for the message. Highness, I can...
She pushed the waterskin into the woman's arms.
When he awakens, he will be thirsty.
Seeing the soldier's wounded expression as she backed away, Jan Tovis could only turn from her, fixing her eyes once more upon the breach.
It's not you who has failed me, she wanted to say to that soldier. It is I who have failed you.
But then she was alone once more, and it was too late.
Brother, are you down there? I cannot see you. Do you stand triumphant once more? I cannot see you. All I can see is what you did yesterday, 1,000 years ago, in the breath just past. When there are none but ghosts left upon the shore, they will sing your praises. They will make of you a legend that none living will ever hear. Gods, the span of time itself must be crowded with such legends, forever lost, yet whispered eternally on the winds. What if that is the only true measure of time? All that only the dead have witnessed, all that only they can speak of, though no mortal life will ever hear them. All those stories forever lost.
Is it any wonder we cannot grasp hold of the ages past? That all we can manage is what clings to our own lives and what waits within reach. To all the rest, we are cursed to deafness. And so, because she knew naught else to do, in her mind Jan Tovis reached out. To that moment a day passed, or a breath ago, or indeed at the very dawn of time, when she saw her brother lead a sortie into the face of the Lyosan centre, and his husked sword howled with slaughter, and, with that voice, summoned a dragon. She tightened the straps of her helm and readied her sword. Down at the breach the Lyosan were pouring like foam from the wound, and Jan Tovis could see her shake buckling. Everywhere but at the centre, where her brother hacked his way forward, and all the enemy reeling before him seemed to be moving at half his speed. He could have been cutting reeds for all the resistance they offered him. Even from this distance, blood washed like a bow wave before Yedan's advance, and behind him Sheikh fighters followed, and she could see how his deadliness infected them, raised them into a state of frenzied fury. From one flank, two leathery companies pushed in to bolster her people, and she watched the line stiffen, watched it plant its feet and hold fast. Jan Tovis set off for the other flank, increasing her pace until she was jogging. Anything faster would have instilled panic in those who saw her. But the longer she took, the closer that flank edged towards routing, and the more of her people died beneath the Lyosan attackers. Her heart thundered, and trembling took possession of her entire body. Into the press, shouting now, forcing her way through. Her fighters found her with wild, frightened eyes, fixed upon her with sudden hope. But they needed more than hope. She lifted her sword and became a queen going to war. Unleashed the battle lust of her royal line, the generation upon generation of this one necessity, this nectar of power, rising within her, taking away the words in her voice, leaving only a savage scream that made those close to her flinch and stare. Huddling in a corner of her mind was a bleak awareness, observing with an ironic half-smile. "Do you hear me, brother? Here on your left? Do you nod in satisfaction? Do you feel my blood reaching to meet yours? Rulers of the Sheikh, once more fighting upon the shore. Oh, we have never been as pathetic as we are at this moment, Yedan. Pathetic in our fate, trapped in our roles, our place in things. We were born to this scene. Every freedom was a lie, a terrible, heart-crushing lie." The enemy was suddenly before her. She greeted them with a smile and then the flash of her sword. To either side, her people rallied, fighting with their queen. They could not let her stand alone. They could not leave her, not now, and what took hold of their lives then was something unruly and huge, a leviathan bristling awake. They struck back, halting the Lyosan advance, and then pushed forward. Light exploded like blood from the wound. Yedan and his wedge of Sheikh fighters vanished in the gushing wave. She saw her brother's followers flung back, tumbling like rag dolls in a hurricane. Weapons flew from hands, helms were torn loose, limbs flailed. They were thrown up against the shins of their kin holding the center line, even as it reeled back to a howling wind that erupted from the wound. In the fiery gale, Yedan stood suddenly alone. Jan Tovis felt ice in her veins.
"Dragon breath!"
A massive shape looming in the breach, filling it, and then out from the fulminating light snapped a reptilian head, jaws open in a hissing snarl, lunging down at her brother. She screamed. Heard the jaws impact the ground like the fist of a god, and knew that Yedan was no longer there. Her own voice now keening, she slashed forward, barely seeing those she cut down. Manic laughter filled the air.
"Hast, awake!"
She broke through, staggered, and saw. The dragon's head was lifting in a spray of blood-soaked sand, the neck arching, the jaws stretching wide once more, and then, as if from nowhere, Yedan Derig was directly beneath that enormous serpent head, and he was swinging his laughing sword, and that glee rose to a shriek of delight as the blade's edge chopped deep into the dragon's neck.
He was a man slashing into the bole of a centuries-old tree. The impact should have shattered the bones of his arms. The sword should have rebounded or exploded in his hands, spraying deadly shards. Yet she saw the weapon tear through that enormous armored neck. She saw the blood and gore erupt in its wake, and then a fountain of blood spraying into the air. The dragon, its shoulders jammed in the breach, shook with the blow. The long neck whipped upward, seeking to pull away, and in the welling gape of the wound in its throat, Jan Tovis saw the gleam of bone. Yedan had cut through to the dragon's spine. Another gloating shriek announced his backswing. The dragon's head and an arm's length of neck jumped away then, off to one side, and the yawning jaws pitched nose down and hammered the strand as if mocking that first lunge. The head tilted and then fell with a trembling thump, the eyes staring sightlessly. The headless neck thrashed upward like a giant blind worm, spitting blood in lashing gouts, and on all sides of the quivering, decapitated beast, black crystals pushed up from the drenched sand, drawing together, rising to form faceted walls, and from every corpse that had been splashed or buried in the deluge, ghostly forms now rose, struggling within that crystal, mouths opened in silent screams. Dodging the falling head, Yedan had simply advanced upon the trembling body filling the breach. Using both hands, he drove the Hust sword, point first, deep into the beast's chest. The dragon exploded out from the wound, scales and shattered bone. Yet even as Yedan staggered beneath the flood of gore, the blood washed from him as would rain upon oil.
"Hust, killer of dragons, you will shield your wielder to keep your joy alive. Hust, your terrible laughter reveals the madness of your maker."
Yedan's desire to trap the corpse of a dragon in the breach was not to be, not this time, for she could see the ruined body being dragged back in heaving lunges.
"More dragons behind this one, crowding the gate. Will another come through to meet the fate of its kin? I think not, not yet, not for some time."
The Leosan on this side of the wound were dead, bodies heaped on all sides. Her shakes stood atop them, two, three deep under their unsteady feet, and she saw the shock in their faces as they stared upon Yedan Derig, who stood before the wound, close enough to take a step through, if he so desired, and take the battle into the enemy's realm. And for a moment she thought he might. Nothing was impossible with her brother, but instead he turned round and met his sister's eyes.
"If you had knelt..."
"No time," she replied, shaking the blood from her sword. "You saw that. They know what you would seek to do, brother. They will not permit it."
"Then we must make it so that they have no say in the matter."
"They were impatient," she said.
He nodded and then faced the fighters.
"They will clear the gate and reform. Captains, draw your units back and reassemble to the rear. Sound the call to the Lethary. Sheikh, you have now stood the shore, and you stood it well."
He sheathed his weapon, silencing its chilling chuckle.
"This is how we shall measure our last days, here on this border drawn with the bones of our ancestors, and none shall move us. Sheikh, tell me when you have come home. Tell me when that truth finally comes to you. You are home."
The words horrified her, but more horrifying still was the answering roar from her people. Yedan seemed surprised, and he turned to her then, and she saw the truth in his eyes.
"Brother, you do not feel it. You do not feel that you have come home. You do not feel as they do."
A flash of something in his gaze, something private between them that shook her as had nothing else, longing, fear, and despair.
"Oh, Yedan, I did not know. I did not know."
Khadagar Phant, Lord of Light, stood trembling before the corpse of Iparth Erul. This was his third visit to the marshalling area before the gate, his third time down from the high wall to stand before the headless dragon lying on its side at the end of a curling swath of broken black shards. The golden scales had dulled, the belly was bloating with gases, and cape moths clustered in the gaping mouth of the severed neck, a mass of fluttering white wings, as if flowers had burst from the corpse in some manic celebration. Apparel Forge looked away from his lord, not ready for him yet. He had sent legion after legion through the breach, and with growing despair watched each one retreat, torn and bloody. Hundreds of his soldiers were lying on dripping cots beneath canopies. He could hear their cries amidst the clatter of weapons being readied for the next assault, and thrice their number rested forever silent in neat rows beyond the cutter trenches. He had no idea how many were lost beyond the breach. 1,000? More? The enemy had no interest in treating Leosan wounded. And why would they?
We would kill their wounded just as quickly, and call it mercy. These are the mechanics of war. It's where logic takes us every time.
Overhead sailed 3 dragons. Like birds startled into the sky, they refused to come down, and had been up there since Ipath's death. Apparel could feel their rage, and something like hunger, as if some part of them, something reptilian and soulless, wanted to descend and feed on that rank carcass. The remaining 7, assembled since the morning, had established discreet encampments on the barrows to either side of the great avenue, with their bespoke legions settled around them. The elites, the true Leosan warriors, yet to draw weapons, yet to advance upon the gate, awaiting only Kadagar's command. When would it come? When would their lord decide that he'd seen enough of his citizens die? Common dwellers of the city, commanded by nobles trapped below the select ranks of the Soul Taken, soldiers only in name, and oh, how they died. Fury seethed in him at the thought.
But I will not look to my lord. I will not beseech him yet again. Will he only relent when they're all dead? For whom, then, this victory?
But he knew the answer to that question. If Kadagar Phant stood alone at the end of all this, if he sat in the gloom of an empty throne room in an empty palace in an empty city, he would still count it a triumph. Winning Carcanus was meaningless. What mattered to the Lord of Light was the absolute annihilation of those who opposed him.
On both sides of the breach. Do you remember, Kadagar, the day the stranger came to Saranhas? We were still children then, still friends, still open to possibilities. But even we shared our shock at his nerve. A human, almost as tall as a Leosan, wearing beneath a tattered woolen cloak a coat of mail that reached down to his ankles, a bastard sword slung under his left arm, long grey hair snarled with indifference, a beard stained the hue of rust beneath the thin lips. He had been smiling. They all agreed on that, from the scouts beyond the walls to the guards at the south gate, to those in the streets who halted to watch him stride towards the citadel at the heart of Saranhas. And he was still smiling when he stepped into the throne room, and your father leaned forward on the high throne, making the bonewood creak. It was Haradagar, your uncle, who growled and reached for his sword. Too much arrogance in this stranger, too much contempt in that smile. But your father lifted a hand, staying his weapon master, and he spoke to the stranger in a tone we'd not heard before.
Kalor, High King, welcome to Saranhas, last city of Tist Leosan. I am Kryn Nephant, champion of High House Light.
Serap's son? Their lord flinched, and Kadagar, I saw the shame in your eyes.
My grandmother, High King, I did not know.
She'd have no reason to tell you, would she?
Kalor looked round.
She was virtually a prisoner here. They even sent her handmaids away. Arrived as a stranger, and as a stranger you were determined to keep her. Is it any wonder she fled this shit bucket?
Haradagar's sword hissed free. Kalor looked over at the weaponsmith and grinned, and whatever Haradagar saw in the High King's eyes stole his courage.
Oh, shame upon shame, Khadagar. Were these your first wounds? I think now that they were. The High King faced Kryn once more. I promised her, and so I am here. Kryn Nephant, your grandmother, Serap, of the Iskian line, is dead. Kryn slowly settled back on the throne, but he now looked shrunken, withering in that bonewood cage.
What? What happened?
Kalor grunted. What happened? I just told you she died. Is that not enough?
No!
Shrugging, the High King said, poison by her own hand. I found her at dawn on the first day of the season of flies, cold and still on the throne I made for her with my own hands. Kryn Nephant, I am her murderer. I remember the silence that followed. I remember how dry my mouth was, and how I could not look anywhere but at this terrible grey man who stood as one without fear, yet spoke words inviting violence. But Fant was shaking his head.
If, you said, by her own hand.
The smile turned into a snarl. Do you truly believe suicide belongs solely to the one taking his or her own life? All that rot about selfishness and self-hatred, the lies we tell ourselves to absolve us of all blame, of all the roles that we played in that wretched death. He raised one chain-clad hand, pointed a finger first at Kryn, and then with a sweeping gesture at all who stood in the throne room. You all had your part to play in her death. The doors you kept locked, the loyal servants and friends you took from her, your ill-disguised whispers behind her back or when she stepped into a room. But I have not come to avow vengeance on her behalf. How can I? The freshest blood of guilt is the pool I now stand in. I could not love her enough. I can never love enough. I killed her. One drop of poison each day for 1,000 years. By her wishes, I return to Serranus. By her wishes, I bring you this. And then he drew from beneath his grey cloak a bedraggled rag doll, flung it so that it slid to the foot of the dais. And in that time, word had travelled out, and now standing inside the doors, 20 paces behind Kalor, stood your father's mother, Serap's daughter. Did Kalor know she was there, listening to his words? Would it have changed anything? She was making this for her daughter, Kalor said, and took it with her when she fled. Unfinished, in fact, little more than knotted cloth and wool. And so it remained for all the centuries I knew and loved her. I surmise, he added, she found it again by accident and decided it needed finishing. On the dawn when I found her, it was settled into her lap like a newborn child. Behind him, Kryn's mother made a wounded sound and sank to her knees. Her servants rushed close. Smiling once more, Kalor unstrapped his weapon harness and let it fall to the tiled floor. The clash rang hollow in the chamber. My words are done. I am the killer of Serap, and I await your kiss of righteous vengeance. And then he crossed his arms and waited. Why do I remember this now, Khadagar? Of course, for all the miserable tragedy of that moment, was it not what came next that truly filled my chest with ashes? Kryn,
his hand lifted, fingers pressed against temple, not even looking up as he gestured with his other hand, and whispered,
"Go, Kello, just go."
And how then I finally understood the High King's smile. Not a thing of pleasure. No, this was the smile of a man who wanted to die. What did we do? We denied him. I remember how he reached down to collect his sword, how he turned away, his back to the throne and the man seated upon it, and walked out. I saw him walk past the huddle of retainers and the woman kneeling in their midst, and he paused, looked down at her. If he said anything then, we did not hear it. If he uttered soft words, none within range ever spoke of them. And then he was walking onward, out and beyond their sight. 4 years later, you swore that you would never sire a child, that all the Leosan would be your children, come the day you ascended to the throne. And I might have laughed, too blind to the future awaiting us all these centuries later. I might have wounded you, as children often do.
Beloved brother,
Aperal turned. Lord,
your thoughts were far away. What were you thinking that could so drag you from this place?
Was there longing in Kadagar's eyes? He didn't think so.
Lord, no more than weariness. A moment's rest.
He looked to the assembled legions.
They are ready. Good.
As he moved to join his retinue, Kadagar stayed him with one hand and leaned close to whisper,
"What were you thinking about, brother?"
"A rag doll. Old friend, it was a moment empty of dreams, a place of grey dust, that and nothing more."
Kadagar let go, stepped back.
"Aperal, is it true?"
"Lord."
"The laughter?"
"Yes, Lord. A hust waits for us in the hands of a Sheikh warrior."
He pointed at the carcass of the dragon.
2 passes of the blade to slice through Ipatherul's neck."
"He must be killed, this Sheikh warrior."
"Yes, Lord."
Kadagar lifted one hand to his brow, reminding Aperal of the father, of poor lost Kryn Nefant.
"But how?"
Aperal cocked his head.
"Lord, why, when all the others have fallen, when he alone remains, when 12 dragons break through. Sire, this is not a legion of hust, it is one sword."
And Kadagar was nodding now, eyes flooding with relief.
"Just so, brother."
He glanced back at the carcass. "Poor Ipatherul.
Poor Ipatherul."
Kadagar Phant, Lord of Light, then licked his lips.
"Such a terrible waste."
In every echo that reached Sandalath Drukolat, she heard ghosts laughing. Withal sat close, down on the stone of the dais, almost at her feet, but it seemed he was dozing, exhaustion making a mockery of his vigil. She did not mind. Mortal failure was ever tinged with irony, was it not? She closed her eyes, listening, waiting for the visions to return. Were these sendings from Mother Dark, or just the cluttered rag ends of all those lives surrendered to these walls and floors of stone?
"Mother, I doubt there is anything of you in these scenes. The gloom is of their own making, and those hard voices rocking so back and forth in my skull, well, I know them all."
One side crimson with blood, Anamanda Rake straightening to face the Hust Legion.
"The invasion has just begun," he told the waiting warriors. "We risk being overwhelmed."
He drew a slow, deep breath, jaws briefly clenching in pain.
"I shall wait for them beyond the rent to deny them the throne of shadow. This leaves the gate itself. Hust Legion, you shall march to the gate. You shall march through it. You shall take the battle to them and hold them there. And," he scanned the rows of helmed faces, "when the last 5 of you remain, you must give your lives to sealing that wound. You shall, hust-armed and hust-armored, forever close Starvald Demelaine.